There can be only one human being in the whole wide world, ladies and gentlemen. Groucho Marx from, I guess that would have been Animal Crackers. That would have been the musical or the show, the film that that was from. Margaret Dumont, of course, as his foil. Groucho, at his height, at his peak, just coming out of the vaudeville and the Broadway circuit, just starting to do movies in the 1930s. Well, you know, our guest on Dave's Gone By wasn't even alive at that point, but like me, became a Groucho Marx fan and follower, and a follower of the Marx Brothers as well, well into the 1960s when he was growing up. But then he had a special opportunity, an amazing, exciting, and ultimately also kind of sad opportunity to get to know Groucho Marx. Because, well, I'll let him tell the whole story, but he's also written the story up in his book. It's called Raised Eyebrows, My Years in Groucho's House, and literally has to do with the 3 years he spent working in the Marx household. It was, the book was actually published several years ago. It's now been reprinted by Bear Manor Media with a cool new cover drawn by Drew Friedman, who, by the way, not to throw in name-dropping here, but we just talked the other week to Bruce J. Friedman, who is the father of the cartoonist who drew the caricature of Groucho that's on the cover of Raised Eyebrows. See how all these things end up connecting in some weird radiological way? Anyway, enough of my spiel. Let us please talk to Steve Stoliar, the author of Raised Eyebrows. Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Good to talk to you. So yeah, I didn't want to give too much away of the story, but you might as well just go right into it and tell us, yes, you were a huge Marx Brothers fan.
We won't give away the ending. We'll let people think that Groucho is still around and he's 121 years old.
He's actually older than Joan Rivers, which is kind of a really scary. He babysat Joan Rivers, which is something. But yeah, you did more than the average Marx Brothers fan of just loving their stuff, reading the books, and trying to see the movies whenever they could. As a matter of fact, that was the main thing. There was a movie that you really wanted to see when you were in college, and you discovered that you could not. Please, Steve Stoliar, take it away.
Well, it's difficult for people of Generation, I guess, X and beyond to understand that there was a time before movies were easily available either on television or cable or VHS or DVD or downloading. And in fact, the Marx Brothers' second film, as you mentioned, Animal Crackers, had never been shown on television and had been out of circulation since the 1950s. And then when it was part of a package of old Paramount films that were sold to Universal in the 50s, there was a legal snag about the rights to the film, and it couldn't be shown again, but Universal didn't care because to them it was just some old black and white movie, and so just forget about it. But my friends and I, being Marx aficionados, thought they really should bring this film out again. It needs to be seen, and it was, you know, the one that gave Hooray for Captain Spaulding, Groucho's theme song. And again, people today think, how could the studio not realize that there was gold in their vault? How could they just... And it's like, no, Universal cared more about Airport 75 than they did about dusting off a Marx Brothers film. So I started up a petition drive at UCLA, where I was initially a history major and then a motion picture television major. And in the course of setting up this petition drive, I actually got to meet my hero. And all I ever wanted to do was just shake his hand and thank him for all the laughs. But I knew that he was old and had been in kind of weak health, and so I figured the chances of that were, you know, less than slim. And yet, there he was, sitting next to me, talking to me about the film, surrounded by hundreds of UCLA students and news cameras and print journalists hanging on his every word. And it was just the most surreal. It was actually literally a dream. I mean, dream come true is used, it's a cliche that's rarely literally true. Like when people say he literally hit the ceiling when he got the electric bill. No, he didn't.
Well, some basketball players do, but they're extremely tall.
But, yeah. Sorry. But I used to dream about meeting Groucho, and then I would wake up and get very frustrated because it was so vivid, and yet, no, it was just a dream. In this case, there he was, and I said, I am very happy to be meeting you after all these years. And he said, well, you should be. And that was sort of the nature of our relationship.
That's
and,
a pretty good
the
impersonation.
Film was,
I was saying that was a pretty good impersonation right there. We just heard Gilbert Gottfried doing his, but you've got a killer Groucho there.
I like Gilbert's material. I'm a stickler for verisimilitude, which I know is a real priority for your listeners who strive for verisimilitude in all walks of life.
Yeah, all three of my listeners really, really care about that kind of thing. So,
yes, a letter poured in just the other day.
It got a 13-cent stamp on it. That's how long it took. The pony just came up 10th Avenue here. I was amazed.
Wow.
I'm sorry, continue. But but how did you go from sitting next to Groucho at the premiere, this re-premiere of Animal Crackers, courtesy of you and UCLA, to knowing him a lot more than just that one conversation?
Well, it was so exciting to have had this culmination of all the efforts to get the film out again and to meet my hero. And then the film came out, and it actually broke the house record at the UA Westwood, which was very gratifying because Universal didn't think anyone would care to see this thing, and it beat French Connection, which had
Whoa.
The previous house record there. So that was very gratifying. And then I thought, I don't want this to go away. I mean, I got in touch with Groucho and with Erin Fleming, the woman who was in charge of his life, and conversations and meetings and that sort of thing, and now I've sort of served my purpose. And then the summer of 74, I had two summer jobs that fell through, for which I shall remain eternally grateful. And I called up Erin Fleming and I said, is there anything that you could use me for that I might be helpful with? And she said, well, actually, I had started out as Groucho's secretary, but now I'm his manager, and we really do need someone to handle the fan mail and to organize all of his memorabilia to be donated to the Smithsonian after he's gone. But it needs to be someone who's familiar with the Marx Brothers' work, and I think you would be... And I think I was there before she hung up the phone.
I imagine.
Like a Tex Avery cartoon or something. And I initially thought, well, I'll probably be working at some Wilshire Boulevard office building, and Groucho will come in once a month to sign checks or something. And she said, oh, no, dear, you'll be working right inside the house, and you can make your own hours and come and go as you wish.
Wow.
And it's like, and I get paid to do this? And so I initially thought, well, I'll work 6 days a week, and then what's good enough for God? I'll rest on Sunday. So I put in a week, and then on Sunday I was sitting at home thinking, why do I want a day off from that? So I showered and dressed and went back. And it's just like I needed to just immerse myself. It was just such a remarkable atmosphere, being such a rabid Marx fan. It wasn't one of those situations where years later you think, if only I'd known and been able to appreciate who these people were at the time. This was like at the pinnacle of my obsession with Groucho. So everything had significance, the photos, the letters, the scrapbooks, the people.
It's almost like you know, John Hinckley getting to bunk with Jodie Foster in kind of a weird way.
Yeah, you know, and it's true. There wasn't any such thing as celebrity stalking back then. And in fact, I wasn't particularly interested in marrying or murdering him. I just wanted to shake his hand. But I did go so far as to try to go where he would be likely to be seen, which is, you know, ludicrous. But I had heard that he ate pizza at a place in Beverly Hills called Jacopo's. And so my friend and I went there one evening and looked at the menu, and there was like the Groucho special. And I said, look, it's, they have a grand, and my roommate said, just because it's on the menu doesn't mean he comes here. You can't go to Cantor's Deli and order the Milton Berle and he serves you the sandwich. So the waitress came over and I said, does Groucho Marx really eat here? And she said, oh, yes. As a matter of fact, he was here, when was it? Yesterday. And he was here right after we opened, and he tried to pay with a $100 bill, and he knew we couldn't make change for that. He's so funny. You should have been here. And so when I awoke, the dead body of the waitress was next to me with a knife in her larynx. But I had the last laugh because I ended up working inside, as Aaron had said, working inside Groucho's house, and what turned out to be a 3-year gig until he died in August of 77.
So you were actually...
Now I'll let you ask a question.
No, absolutely. Great to let you get the whole story out. I didn't want to interrupt that at all. But I didn't realize that you were... Because I started to read the book. I just got it like a couple of days ago. So I haven't been able to read through the whole story. But I didn't realize you were physically part of that whole scene until the very end. I thought that things got so bad in a way, and especially, we'll talk about Aaron Fleming, that you were kind of pushed out long, you know, a few months before he was gone, but you were there till the bitter end.
Yeah, I spent those 3 years waiting to be fired, or waiting, assuming that his days were numbered in the, you know, double digits maybe, and always being pleasantly surprised that I had underestimated what was happening. I mean, even, I think it was about 3 weeks into working there, and I had really gotten into the rhythm of the place and was feeling more comfortable there, and I showed up and rang the bell, and the maid answered and said, please be quiet, Mr. Marx has had a stroke. And I thought, oh God, it's all, you know, the coach is turning back into a pumpkin just as I'm getting used to this. And but when I went back, instead of finding Groucho in his bedroom lying, you know, comatose, he was propped up in bed in his PJs with his mucklucks on reading the paper, and said, is the ambulance here yet?
Huh.
No, figures. And he goes back. I mean, it was like, yeah, another stroke. And then again, I know we haven't gotten into the Fleming situation,
right,
but she was at the very least a mercurial and a difficult woman, and she hired and fired the household staff
daily, almost, you know, one of those kinds of things, or...
Oh. I'm sorry, what did you say?
I'm saying she like, daily or weekly, there would be, you know, someone would just drop a dish and then they'd be out the door? Was that the kind of thing?
Well, there was one, for the people who think that Groucho wasn't aware of how things were going, there was one time at the lunch table, Groucho said, what's the matter, Aaron, aren't you feeling well? And she said, I feel fine, Groucho, why? And he said, you haven't fired anyone this week.
Hmm. And this was, so, I guess, late in, like towards the later period. See, the thing about Fleming is when you start reading the book, and when you were talking just before about how you got into the whole household, she sounds really great. I mean, you know, she seems very...
I will always owe her the fact that she... You know, she opened that door into Oz where everything turns from sepia to technicolor. And, there's no shortage of negative things to say about her. But, as all of our listeners who follow the writings of André Gide know, the color of truth is gray. And so when people ask me about Aaron, they'll say, I don't understand. Was she this woman who put her life on hold to devote herself to Groucho when his kids had sort of turned their backs on him and was devoted to him and working on his behalf to put him back on top? And or was she like this, you know, Cruella de Vil, cruel, abusive woman? And it's like, essentially, whatever you've heard about her, yes.
Yeah. Well,
that people aren't one-dimensional. In her case, the highs and lows were, you know, dizzying, as opposed to most people, where the highs and lows are more easily seen on the seismograph.
Well, when I looked up your book on Amazon, the book being Raised Eyebrows, My Years in Groucho's House, someone made a rather interesting comment, not so much in her defense, but as an explanation of saying, you know, she got in deep in a way that she perhaps did not necessarily expect. She hooked up with a funny, charming, famous, granted very, very much older man, and wanted to be sort of his manager and protector and secretary and possibly on some weird level lover. And then just as it kept going on and he kept getting weaker and more physically, literally, you know, disabled, as it were, that just she wasn't expecting that, and that made her abusive and cruel. Is there any truth perhaps in that?
I think it lets her off the hook a little bit. And it's sort of that's the blaming the victim hypothesis, that it's because Groucho was getting older and weaker that it made her abusive. It's very complicated, and she was, first of all, she was literally and clinically schizophrenic, which does not mean split personality. The schism in schizophrenia is between the person and reality, not between warring personalities.
Oh.
So she was...
I did not know that. Yes, you did. No, I didn't. Yes, I did. Sorry. Yeah, continue. Sorry.
Steve hang up? Oh, my God, I think he hung up.
Forgive me. No, please continue. No, and you're right. It's this her versus the world, not her versus herself, necessarily.
Well, reality.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she was paranoid. She saw, you know, people out to get her when there was nothing behind it. I mean, it wasn't as bad in the Groucho years. It got worse after he died. But she, you know, she was on a number of medications, and she was, you know, just not quite right in the head. In addition to being in charge of this frail man, and as he grew weaker, he grew more dependent on her because she had been there when no one else was. And so he gradually began to rely on her more and more to make business decisions and social decisions and that sort of thing. But I don't think she ever really... She didn't really accept the fact that he was a man from 1890 who had had health problems and was getting older. I think she could only see Groucho Marx, the legend, the name, and really at the expense of what was best for him as a human being. And his friends and family, some of his friends and family had been alienated by her, which is such a frequent thing with once strong male personalities that end up linking up with some young ambitious woman towards the end. And, you know, she wanted to have a TV special when he was just months from death, and she was thinking, oh, it'll be great, we'll do it in his living room, and we'll have all these stars will come in here. And it was like, you know, the other household staff and I would talk and think, how can she possibly still be planning on this? He just had another stroke, or now he's in a wheelchair or something. And she couldn't see reality. She only saw, well, part of it was ambition, because she was going to produce that show. And she was, I mean, she was certainly verbally and emotionally abusive. I saw her, you know, scream at him and cause him to cry on several occasions. And it was heartbreaking. And people have said, well, why didn't you do something? And it's like, I was 19 or 20, and she was in charge. So if I, you know, tried to say, stop behaving that way, she would have just said, pack your pencil, pal.
Was she ever physically abusive? That
I
you
didn't
saw?
See it. Mm. I don't think so. I hope not. I know she at least threw a napkin at him, cloth napkin, forcibly. But, you know, when you get into psychology a little bit, you realize that the adage about sticks and stones may break your bones, but names will never hurt you. The names are much more insidious and lasting than whatever you could set with, you know, a cast and Vicodin. And so, I mean, hearing her scream at him, you stupid, senile son of a bitch, why can't you remember the jokes? To the point where he would be shaking and a tear rolling down his cheek. I don't know that that's any better than slapping him. You know, I think it's worse.
Yeah, and although at the same time, we have to, you know, roll it back and imagine that you did not get that job, that summer, 3 year summer job at the Groucho household, and you were just a Marx Brothers fan, and you were paging through TV Guide, and you saw that there would be one more special with Groucho, no matter how old and how infirm. I mean, you would have watched. You would have been like, oh, my God, Groucho's back on TV. So again, to give her some props, yeah, you were physically in it. You saw how sick and frail and old he was.
But if I had only been that fan thumbing through TV Guide, I would have, you know, warmed up the zenith and then seen this frail, wheelchair-ridden, slurring man and thinking, why have they put this man on TV like this?
Okay.
I mean, the first time I saw him was when he had his one-man show in 1972 at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. He had done it at Carnegie Hall, and then he was the one Los Angeles appearance. And the press at the time had perpetuated the idea that good old Groucho, at 80 years old, just as sharp and funny as ever. So I expected to see essentially the host of You Bet Your Life, but older and maybe a little slower, but unmistakably intact. And this old man shuffled out to a podium and started reading off of 3x5 cards, and it was like getting hit in the chest with a sledgehammer. And I resented the press for sort of protecting. It's like if he never showed himself, they could get away with it, but it's like that, you know, auditorium full of people. And so, you know, people said, was it disillusioning to spend time with him because he had gotten old? And I said, no, it was actually reillusioning him, because I was disillusioned when I saw his one-man show. But then I realized that in the comfort of his home, instead of in front of 10,000 people and a spotlight, he could be delightful. He was his stories of vaudeville and making the films and the people he knew, and his ability to, I mean, it's like one Christmas he was sent a tin of candied almonds by Portland Allen, Fred Allen's widow. And so he stuck his head in the room that I used at the house, and he said, send her one of my Christmas cards. And I said, don't you want to say anything personal? And he thought, and he said, well, tell her thanks for the nuts, hope you're the same.
Oh, cute.
Was off the cuff. And he used to love to get the Hollywood trade papers along with his mail. And he came to the lunch table one day and he said, wonderful mail you brought me. Nothing but requests for money. And I said, well, you got a Variety, didn't you? And he said, yes, a Variety of requests for money. Now, that's the kind of line he would have phrased exactly like that
of
at
course.
Any point in his life.
Or S.J. Perlman would have phrased it for him. I mean, it's just straight right out of it. You know, beautiful. We've covered sort of the depressing track of his going downhill and his relationship.
Well, you can edit all that out before you broadcast this.
Well, concerning the fact that we're on live, not
live.
Bloody likely.
Live? You mean...
Yes.
Yes, I understand.
So when Aaron Fleming said, son of a bitch, I was like, okay, at least she didn't say the other thing. So we're able to say that. But let me ask... before we leave the Aaron Fleming stuff, was she his girlfriend? Or did he just like
I
to...
never talked to anyone in a position to know... Mm. Who ever thought there was really anything physical between them? I mean, you know, Groucho milked that. Like, if you see the Cavett show, he'll say, like, this is my secretary, which is a euphemism. But, you know, I don't really think there was, at that point in Groucho's life and health and, you know. But he was certainly kind of infatuated with her. And he loved, you know, having a young, attractive person doting on him and squiring him about to various Hollywood functions. But I don't think there was anything romantic between them.
Even in the early, even like in 1971 or two.
Well, I mean, I don't know. But, I mean, from talking to Andy Marks and people that were in the household then, you know, you can't know. I mean, nobody was, like, hiding under the bed, but it's easy for people at a great distance to say, yeah, you can't tell me that, you know, that he wasn't messing around. You know, well, I don't know, but no one seems to think that that was what was really going on.
Well, actually, did she have her own bedroom? I mean, was she living there?
No.
Uh-huh.
Various misconceptions. I've heard her referred to as his wife, living together, da 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 da. Not dissimilar from the Mia Farrow thing, where, you know, people say, "Oh, he married his daughter," and it's like, no, he never spent the night at Mia's place. They were never married. Da da da. Erin had her own house in West Hollywood that Groucho, you know, was picking up the tab for. She had an office that used to be Eden's bedroom, Groucho's last wife.
But it was just an office,
Pardon?
But it was just an office, so.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I'm sorry to disappoint you.
No, not this point. I mean, I assumed, especially at his age, as you said, she was a young, attractive woman. And by the way, if anybody wants to see Erin Fleming, she was an actress. Her best known role, you mentioned Woody Allen, was Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask. She has a part in one of the skits in there. And so, as you said, he probably was just enamored of her, liked to look at her, liked a young, attractive woman around, and that was enough. That was all, probably physically, that's all he could even expect. So, you know, As again, as you said, the André Gide quote, "The truth is shades of gray," or I kind of got that wrong, however he put it. He put it in French,
yes,
so I couldn't
did,
have gotten it that
picked
wrong.
Him up, she picked him up and dusted him off at a time when, you know, it's like you bet your life had been off the air for years. And the mid-late 60s, he was just sort of doing guest spots on TV shows and talk shows. And it was sort of before the whole renaissance of interest in the Marx Brothers, although you can't really credit Aaron with generating that. It was already underway.
It was
in
the college
late 60s
kids.
With the baby boomers embracing the anarchy of the Marx Brothers. You know, the Smothers Brothers and Cavett's initial shows were before they had even met, and the audience would go crazy that Groucho was on.
Hey,
but
can I ask,
she did, you know, shape and push and guide those last years so that he was once again a living legend. But then the people that were really long, long time friends felt that she was doing him a disservice by exposing him in such a vulnerable way. But if you asked Groucho, he would be happy you know, he loved having an auditorium full of people standing up and applauding. Well, who wouldn't want that?
Yeah. So, and I mean, it's again, it's there are two sides to this coin. I mean, I just a few weeks ago on this program, I had Marty Allen, you know, the comedian, the bushy-haired comedian from Allen
and
Lucy.
Hello there.
That's right, exactly. And he's still, thank God, alive and well, and still performing on cruise ships and in Vegas. And he's 90 or 91 years old.
Wow.
And still, I mean, I can sort of tell that he still has it. But he's there with his wife of many years. She's a bit younger, not like in her 30s or anything like that. Is she kind of pushing him? Or is she the one who's saying, this is what he loves to do? What would he be doing? He'd be sitting home in an armchair watching TV. So if he's a little bit older, let's get him out there. You know, he digs it.
Did she push him or did he jump?
I have a feeling he definitely jumped. With Mickey Rooney, not sure. I saw him do a show a couple of years ago at the Irish Repertory Theater, where you know he does his tour thing where he goes up and he talks about his life, and it's all he's rigging off monitors. And I mean, there was one point, honestly, where he had buttoned his suit wrong, and she's on stage like rebuttoning his suit. You know, Mickey's an old man, and it was a little vaguely embarrassing, but at the same time, my God, it's Mickey Rooney up there, and he loves her. It was obvious,
and
she wants to be there.
In his case, I don't think Jan Rooney is one of those cold, calculating, ambitious, driven women that has pushed Mickey out there. I think Mickey's ego, which has never been wanting and is in inverse proportion to his height, is I think that's behind it. And I do think she's good for him. And I think that wasn't there something with his son where he's sort of the Aaron Fleming character in terms of being abusive and.
Yeah, I read that later. That came out like a year or two after I saw the show. So that's what I'm saying. It's like I really felt that as old as he was and as kind of like disappointing as the show was, not so much because he was frail and forgetting lines of reading off a thing, but just because he didn't really say anything. It was all stuff you could have read in a wiki autobiography of
Judy
him.
Like a sister. We never had a romance, and she was just terrific, and they don't make pictures like they did.
I'm sorry.
Thank you for that. How many impersonations or impressions, I always get the two confused, but how many do you do?
Well, my saving grace is that I tend to do people no one else does because there's no competition.
Kevin McCarthy.
It's like in the Could Have Been a Contender speech from On the Waterfront. I do the Steiger part.
What are you talking about? You saw some money. I had some bets down. You better make up your mind before we get to 437 River Street.
So, you see, it's like no one says, oh, anybody can do Rod Steiger. So, but we digress.
No. Please, do you have any others? People that I vaguely would have heard of? Sorry?
Huh?
Anybody that I vaguely would have heard of? Other impressions that you do?
No, I don't want to do people you've heard of.
Well, no, vaguely heard of. I mean, I've heard of Rod Steiger.
Oh, vaguely heard of.
Yeah.
Ralph Bellamy.
Go for it.
I was often cast in the role that I would call the gooseberry, which is the fella who doesn't get the girl. It was usually Cary Grant, and that's why I like the Roosevelt picture.
Pretty good. I mean, I don't remember Ralph Bellamy that well, but I'm sure you were doing. But you know what? In your Ralph Bellamy, I hear that you could do Jimmy Stewart if you wanted to. I hear it.
Yeah, but I don't want to.
Okay, that's totally fair. Hey, the one thing I forgot.
George, you once came to me and said I was nothing but a warped, frustrated old man.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it's real good. And then before we go, you will have to do a little more old Groucho, just because you do it so stunningly well.
Oh, well, I had plenty of experience watching and listening.
Did you ever do old Groucho for Groucho? Or that
no.
Been, no, I would imagine not. Hey, Steve Stolniar, the author of the book Raised Eyebrows, My Years in Groucho's House, who were some of the celebrities and like luminaries that you met coming through?
What a galaxy. See, that's the, you know, we were talking, you know, it's we get pulled into the dark side, but oh my heavens, let's not shortchange the fact that this was a world-class dream coming true for me, getting to know not only Groucho, but his other brothers, Zeppo and Gummo, were still around.
Wow.
And so I spent time with them. As a matter of fact, Zeppo and I dated the same girl at one point.
Now, wait a minute. Well, yeah, so this was in the press materials for the re-release of your book. How old was he?
She was 19, I was 20, and he was 74.
All right. Okay.
It was a December of the following year thing. But they only went out once, and it's fine, but I love telling people. It is technically true, because I took her to dinner there once when he was coming up, when he was up from Palm Springs, and she was attractive and young and bright, and he... You know, he sort of picked up where Chico left off in terms of womanizing and gambling. Mm. And he really, you know, people say, is it true that he was funny? Because it isn't in the movies, you know. And it's true. He really lit up a room when he walked in.
Oh.
He seemed decades younger than he was. And he had a great sense of humor and just a great spirit. And so he was quite taken with her. And when she and I broke up, I sent him a letter saying, you know, you've been around the block once or twice. Do you have any advice for the lovelorn? And instead of advice, he called me up from Palm Springs. And he said, listen, I don't want to step on your toes or anything, but do you think that Linda would go out with me?
Oh, wow. And she did. Well, for one date.
For one date, yes. He took her to dinner in San Diego and to a Hi-Li game in Tijuana.
Whoa.
So now I guess she has a story to tell as well. But
have you been in touch? Is she alive? Is she?
Oh, she's alive, yeah. I haven't been in touch with her since the collegiate days.
Oh.
But anyway, so in addition to Zeppo and Gummo, oh my gosh, Mae West, Bob Hope, George Burns, Milton Berle, Steve Allen, S.J. Perelman, Nat Perrin.
So Groucho wasn't really 100% forgotten. I mean, he would get amazing visitors, you know, to say
no,
hi.
No, and of course I wasn't there during whatever period he could have been said to be, you know, out of the limelight. But he never really craved the company of celebrities so much as stimulating company. And if they happened to be celebrities, that was fine. But like at the at MGM, he would not sit at the stars table. It didn't matter to him to sit with Clark Gable and Greta Garbo and Robert Taylor. He would much rather sit at the writer's table because the actors tended to be kind of self-involved and not very deep. But the writers were the ones that were talking about what's happening politically and swapping stories and clever and stimulating, and that's what he thrived on. So most of his longtime friends, you know, Arthur Sheikman, Nat Perrin, Maury Riskin, Nunnally Johnson, the people who pop up in the Groucho letters, those were the people whose company he thrived on, not so that he could call someone up and say, you'll never guess who came to lunch. You know,
right, yeah, no, I get it. I mean, who's really going to be more famous than him, except maybe a president? But can you give us, see, I'm afraid that it's going to turn into like the Mickey Rooney show where he drops all these names, and it's like, oh, great, he drops all. Tell us some things to remember about when these people came to dinner. Were you there? I mean, were you able to be in the room, or?
Well, all right, we'll deal with probably the most legendary name. Rip Taylor came to lunch once.
Rip Taylor? Rip Taylor came.
I know, it's such a collision of different comedic style. It's like when you see the movie, the original of The Italian Job, you've got Benny Hill and Noel Coward in the same film, and it's a little like that.
Although, actually, if you think about it, Harpo and Rip Taylor are cut in some ways from the same cloth.
Sort of.
So that's not totally off the wall, but yeah, please continue.
The same shimmering LeMay. one of Groucho's cooks was a rather flamboyant young man, and he was friends with Rip Taylor, so he arranged for Taylor to come to lunch one day. And Groucho shuffles to the table and sits down and looked at him and said, "What do you do?" And he said, "I'm a comedian." And he says, "Really, you haven't said anything funny yet." And so Taylor said, "Well, I usually start my act. I walk out in an outfit covered in tinsel, and I say, 'It looks like someone shot the Christmas tree.'" And Groucho said, "And then what, you go home?"
Oof.
It's a wonderful moment.
What, was Taylor offended, or was it any insult from Groucho is still love?
It was awkward,
yeah.
And I don't think Rip is used to having that, because he's, you know, mostly used to people saying, "Oh, God, I love you, and you're so funny." But I thought it was wonderful, because it was such a typically Groucho, you know, "Well, I'll take the wind out of your sails, Mr. Funny Man."
Ouch.
George Burns.
Yeah.
This was before, this was right before the Sunshine Boys. As a matter of fact, when he came to lunch, Jack Benny was still in rehearsal to play opposite Matthau, and it was only Benny's death that led to George Burns being cast, which led to his whole renaissance. But I certainly wasn't wanting for things to appreciate George Burns for. I mean, the Paramount comedies and Burns and Allen on radio and TV, and I mean, so he came to lunch one day, and I was nervous, and I opened the door, and he just breezed in, said, "Hi, you want to live a long time? Become an actor. You live to be an old man like Groucho and me. Okay, let's eat."
Huh. Oh, that's so cool.
I know. And then listening to the two of them at the lunch table, by the way, Groucho was very democratic. Well, literally, he was a lifelong Democrat, but beyond that, he never felt like, you know, the help should eat in the kitchen. It was like there was no class delineation. I was welcome at the lunch or dinner table or parties or whatever. And our relationship was sort of, you know, I'm not going to flatter myself and say we became good friends, but I would, it was more than employer-employee. I was sort of like
extended family.
A nephew, or, you know, yeah. Sort of a, he appreciated the fact that I appreciated a lot of the people and stuff that he was into, and I wasn't just some, you know, blue-jeaned hippie freak, but actually, you know, loved the Algonquin Round Table and Gershwin and things like that. But when Burns, you know, it's like listening to the two of them talk about, you know, "You remember that it was Proctor's Theater on 62nd Street. No, Groucho, you're thinking of Chicago, and it was the Orpheum Theater because it was next to the drugstore. The guy had the daughter with the legs." And it was like, oh, my God, they're arguing about some place they played like in 1912.
Wow.
That was another thing.
Yeah.
Was in addition to appreciating Groucho as Groucho Marx, the guy with the grease paint mustache in Monkey Business and Duck Soup and on You Bet Your Life, he was also this guy who personally knew W.C. Fields and George Gershwin,
right,
and Irving Berlin and George Kaufman. And then on the third level, he was this human from 1890 who was, you know, he remembered everything from before the Wright brothers to after the moon landing.
Wow.
Which is staggering. And I, you know, I one time I remember saying, "How far back do you remember?" And he thought, and he said, "I guess the Spanish-American War, which is 1898.
I mean, that was not a joke. He's literally saying that he was 8 years old.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, wow.
I mean, as a boy singer, he was part of the lineup of people who sang at a benefit to raise money for the victims of the San Francisco earthquake. So he was this living time capsule to being
that was 1904,
a first-hand friend with all of these mythic figures that you don't think of in three dimensions in color. And then, of course, he was my hero.
No.
So it was just an amazing 3 years.
And actually, well, we only have a couple more minutes with Steve Stoliar, but I just love hearing all these stories about Groucho. I want to remind everybody, first of all, that his book is called Raised Eyebrows, My Years in Groucho's House. It's been reprinted by Bear Manor Media and available at all the usual places. Is there a particular website that you want to guide them to?
Well, yeah, Amazon, you know, I wish it were at all the usual places. The problem is all the usual places are evaporating.
Well, yeah, that's fair.
Unless you're talking about online. To me, the usual place is the bookstore near your house where you can go down and thumb through stuff, but the Wrecking Ball is making short work of them. So I don't know that it's to be found in that many brick-and-mortar, as they say, bookstores, but it is certainly on Amazon, and it's also on Bear Manor Media's website. So,
and do they have a Kindle?
It isn't hiding, but you're not likely to trip over it getting the paper in the morning.
Well, is it also on Kindle or that weird? I don't even do
it
this
isn't
yet.
It is Kindle but. Yet. It's going to be, and also I'm going to do an audiobook of it. Big surprise after talking to me, right?
Well, if you're going to do the voices, that would be fantastic. Do you have a website of your own?
No.
Oh, okay.
I'm us living fossils. We get pulled into the 21st century very reluctantly. My computer operates a combination of Steam and foot pedals.
And actually, when you picked up the phone, you had to crank it before you could even get on the air.
I'm trying to jiggle holding the receiver and the candlestick part of the rest of it and still be able to. All right.
Now, before we leave people with the impression that Steve Stoliar's life kind of stopped with the death of Groucho and nothing ever happened with him since then, you actually ended up working in television for a long time. I mean, what happened after your college years, after your Groucho years?
My life stopped.
Oh, no, wait.
I'm sorry. You said it didn't stop. After college, I was a production secretary at Universal Studios, which, again, was another kind of Wonderland thing because at lunchtime I'd just go nosing around the sound stages and see where the Phantom of the Opera was shot, and you know, and I was typing every imaginable Kojak, Beretta, Rockford Files kind of thing for a paycheck, and then just kind of drinking in the whole, you know, I see Hitchcock be driven in every day.
Oh.
I met Lauren Bacall when she was on Rockford Files, of all weird things.
Steve, one moment. When you say you were typing up these Beretta and Kojak things, does that mean you were secretary taking the scripts and formatting them, or you were writing Kojaks and Berettas?
You kids today with your formatting. It was a typewriter. It was a Selectric 2. The Steno Pool would be given rough versions of the scripts, either out of the typewriters of the writers and producers, or sometimes handwritten, or sometimes earlier drafts that had been printed. And we would type up chunks of whatever they were doing that month, television and film.
But that was administrative. You did that. So it is. I mean, I call it formatting in the new computer way of the world, but you had to format it in proper printed, old-fashioned types. It had to be typed. It had to be spelled correctly. It had to be in a certain, you know, centered
30,
name and whatever.
Wait a second. 30, 35, 50, 57, 65, 85, and 102. Those are the tab settings.
Yeah, there you go.
I didn't realize I remembered those.
See? But you also wrote for TV, didn't you?
I wrote for TV. I wrote Murder, She Wrote, and Simon and Simon, and a couple of Sliders, and the new WKRP in Cincinnati. I wrote a bunch of material for Dick Cavett when I moved to New York in the early 80s, and that was another wondrous adventure in my life, drinking in the whole Manhattan experience.
Wow.
Which, you know,
and you had
become like a big brother to me because of the Groucho experience, which was Dick Cavett.
So that's when you were with Groucho, that's when you, of course, met Dick Cavett, because he was this, you know, huge kind of professional friend to Groucho. And then later on, he called you, you called him. How did you get the gig writing for Cavett?
Well,
it was
I started writing Cavett when I was working for Groucho, and then hearing back from him was so exciting, and when Groucho died, I figured, well, that's going to be it for Dick Cavett, because I was this pipeline into the Groucho household, and now what use would I be to him? And the week Groucho died, I had never spoken to him on the phone. Cavett called New York and said, listen, just because Groucho's gone, I hope we're not going to lose touch. And by the way, I hope you don't mind, but I've shown some of your letters to Woody, and he says they're very well written.
Wow.
So it's like, empty the urine out of my shoes. that he calls and says, I hope we won't lose touch, like I'm going to shoot him out of a cannon because Groucho's gone. And then the fact that he hopes I don't mind that he showed some of my letters to Woody. And now Woody Allen and I are correspondents, speaking of typewriters.
I hope you've saved all these letters and you have them, you know, properly in vellum or however you... you know.
I have them properly stuck in a bureau drawer.
Okay, then, fair enough. Fair,
but, they're, you know, they exist.
Well, yeah. Just never have a fire.
let me write that down. I have to set the candlestick phone down, and then I'll set something on fire with the candlestick. Wait a second.
Don't well, you know what? Okay. Quite honestly, man, I know you're kind of old guard and Luddite, but get yourself a scanner, and one day open that drawer and... sorry?
What? I have a scanner. I've been electronically mailing people. I don't do the tweet thing, but I do the Facebook thing.
But what I'm saying is you take that scanner and you take that drawer full of old letters and you bloody
and
well PDF
them.
Each one of them, you know.
Yeah.
Seriously.
You're right. I mean, I've done that with a few, mostly to send to close friends because of something in one of the letters. But yes, I've got photos signed by people and letters from all, you know, Lillian Gish and Al Hirschfeld and Dr. Seuss, and there's a lot of stuff that's come my way over the years.
Well, you know, they're in your drawer, which is wonderful for you, but, you know, God forbid that drawer, you know, gets lost, you know, something horrible happens to that, or just the fact that it's there or it may go to a museum one day, that still leaves 100 billion people out in the cold who would want to read and see these amazing things.
You're saying I owe it to the world to preserve these for posterity?
No joke. Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. I mean, hasn't it crossed your mind?
I'm so protective of it because there's things that are just, like, weren't meant to be published. And so just as I was protective of Groucho, which is one of the reasons it took me years to write the book, was I thought, you know, I was such a footnote to his life. How could I possibly have enough to say? And he was old, and so.
Well,
you know,
but fair.
I don't
but,
know, but
yeah.
But I know what you mean, and you're right. There's no cogent argument against having them copied in some floor mat.
And with all due respect, I'm sure a ton of these people are no longer with us, so it's especially, it's not making a step up. All right, Rip Taylor, perhaps. Rip Taylor's still with us, isn't he?
I have a five-page handwritten letter from Marlena Dietrich about the making of the Blue Angel.
You're the only human being who has this.
A bookstore owner I knew, I was in his store one day, and he said, do you want Marlena Dietrich's address? And I thought, sure. So I wrote her a letter, and I always find it's better to ask a question rather than saying, I loved you in all these movies, and you're so pretty. And and I asked her about the shooting of Blue Angel, because it was in English and in German. Did they shoot the whole film in German and then in English, or did they alternate languages scene by scene, because both ways seemed awkward? And I thought, I've got nothing to lose but postage. And I get this handwritten letter about how von Sternberg did it, and that she spoke English because she had governesses, and Emil Janning spoke English, but some of the others had to do it phonetically, and it's like, oh, my God.
You owe that to film history, dude, to share that. You know, I don't think Joseph von Sternberg will mind. I really don't.
I was having a hot dog with Joe last Thursday, and he said, please don't.
Is it true that he only has mustard, no ketchup? Is that
I'm sworn to secrecy.
Oh, man. So, Steve Stoliar, it is 12:02 in the afternoon. I'm way overtime on this, but obviously we've had a fat... No, please. Don't be Sorry, I know I've only even scratched the surface of your stories with Groucho and then post-Groucho in the TV and Hollywood world. What have you been doing in the past, like, more recent times, decade or so?
I worked at a small production company writing and producing pop culture documentaries on everyone from Martin Luther King to John Lennon and the Marx Brothers.
So you're the producer?
Boy, just a hodgepodge of different things.
Good Lord. And you've been doing this. What's the most recent project that you did?
The most recent project is writing the afterword for the new edition, because the book Raised Eyebrows came out in hardcover in 96, and then people have wondered, what's happened to these people? Did you ever hear from so-and-so about the book? It's like I had all these experiences just since 96 when the book came out, going back to Groucho's house for the first time in 35 years, which was like... I felt like Rod Taylor in the Time Machine, because the place had all been reconfigured, but I was like inhabiting the same space in a different time.
Who has it now? Different. Who's there? Or is it a museum?
It isn't the there has changed. It really has been so completely reconfigured that you can't even say it's the same house. I mean, they removed the fireplace and moved the swimming pool several feet. And I went with, the realtors had it open so people could come through that were interested in paying $13.3 million. I wasn't really all that interested. So I was going through with friends of mine, and I felt like some kind of psychic tour guide, just walking through, staring blankly straight ahead. And then with my hands, I'd say, you see this wall? That was Melinda's bedroom. You see this room? That was a wall. And this kitchen was the library. I mean, it was just totally different, very surreal. So I talk about that in the afterword and, what's become of some of the dramatis personae.
In fact, the one thing we didn't say is what ended up happening to Aaron Fleming, and we're not going to say it because it's going to be like the teaser. It's going to thing the thing that will get you on the hook to. I mean, sure, you can go on Wikipedia and find out, but don't go to Amazon and get.
Don't fly down to the rainforest. Don't go to the Amazon. I don't want to be responsible for people doing that and getting hit with poison darts.
Yeah, you
go to Amazon.com and order Raised Eyebrows, My Years Inside Groucho's House.
By Steve Stoliar, Stoliar. By the way, have I been pronouncing that correctly the whole time?
No, but, big deal.
What is it? What is it actually?
Oh, Stoliar, like stole your time.
Oh, boy. All right, I should have asked that at the very beginning of the show, shouldn't I have? Steve Stoliar.
Let's do it again, then. That was just the dress rehearsal.
There you go. That dress rehearsal in front of my many, many 3.5 listeners on Dave's Gone By.
Does this remain somehow listenable even after you and I have stopped moving our lips?
Well, you know, Steve, you've been listening to my radio show for all these years, hint, hint. Yes, it does. You can go to davesgoneby.com and all the archives of the episodes that we've been doing of this show, really from the very beginning back in 2002. They're all there. They're free to listen to. davesgoneby.com. You'll have to wait a day or two for this episode to be up online, but it will
be. Because I've jabbered on too long.
I could listen to this jabber. It's like you, Groucho, worrying that he's boring you. Ain't gonna happen.
Yeah,
that kind of thing. But
That's what Bob Whitey ran into trying to do the Woody Allen documentary. The biggest problem was convincing Woody. Woody kept saying, "Who's gonna want to sit and listen to me talk about my childhood and show where I grew up? No one's gonna want to see that." And it's like, "Oh, why don't you just let me do it?"
Well, wait a minute. He did get a documentary done. It was Wild Man Blues about 10 years ago.
No. This is the one that was on PBS last month. Woody Allen, a documentary. It's magnificent.
And you were involved in that?
Marginally.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool. But I did not get to see
it. Even though I wasn't that involved with it, it's still wonderful.
Oh, cool. No, I thought I may have misheard, because I thought you said you were involved in doing a documentary on Woody Allen. Or tried to.
No, I mean, I helped a bit on this, but it really is Bob Whitey's baby, and it should win an Emmy at the least.
Well, oh, he directs a lot of the Curb Your Enthusiasm things. Cool. Oh, good, yeah, right. No, I have to see that now. Thank you for letting me know. And before we leave Steve Stolier, I will ask...
Yes, we'll take a few calls.
No, I don't have to. I have another guest. I'm pushing this other guest off.
Oh, well, that's all right. You pushed me 5 minutes, so...
But let me ask, can you leave us with a little bit of Hello, I Must Be Going, as, of course, old Groucho. We have to hear it. You got to do it. Please.
And not to be confused with Hello, I Must Be Garing, which would have been one of the numbers cut from Springtime for Hitler.
Yeah, you know, I love that song. I do.
I must be going. I cannot stay. I came to say I must be going. I'm glad I came, but just the same, I must be going.
Tra-la.
Thank you, Steve Stolier. Have a great one.
My pleasure, Dave.
And let's keep in touch. I want to see your website with all those letters and things printed and online and available for the world to read. That's what I want to see from you.
Yeah, well, when you get that web address, I want to see it too, so let me know what it is.
We can collaborate. We'll see. We'll talk. Have a great
all
one.
Right.
Thank you
Take
so
care.
Much, man. It's been a joy.